Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. Nice to have you along today and thank you for tuning in. My name is Henrik Palmgren and we are coming to you from Sweden in Scandinavia. We are here on Thursdays and Sundays, but you can tune in to our program anytime you please, 24/7 through our website redicecreations.com, where we also cover news and research in many different areas that we consider to be of importance and of interest. Today we are going to discuss all things related to human version 2.0. We're going to discuss robotics, human machine and computer interfaces, and cyborg research, among many other things. We have Kevin Warwick with us on the line. He is professor of cybernetics at the University of Reading in England, where he carries out research in artificial intelligence, control, robotics and biomedical engineering. Kevin has carried out a series of pioneering experiments involving the neurosurgical implantation of a device into the median nerves of his left arm in order to link his nervous system directly to a computer in order to assess the latest technology for use with the disabled. He has been successful with the first extrasensory or ultrasonic input for the human, for a human. And with the first purely electronic communication experiment between the nervous system of two humans. This is very interesting research, and I'm looking forward to talking more with Mr. Warwick about all these things and much more here today. I also want to mention that he is the author of iCyborg, and in some circles he actually has actually been referred to as the first cyborg because of this implant that he has in his left arm, and we'll discuss that a little bit more later in the program. I'd also recommend taking a look at his website. Simply go to kevinwarwick.com. There you can find a lot of information about his research, his publication, how to get a copy of his book, of course, photo galleries, and much more. So with that, let's bring on our guest. Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio, Mr. Warwick. I know that you're a very busy man, so we're very thankful to have you on the line here today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. It's great.
Brilliant. You have a very long bio. You've been involved in a lot of different projects and research over the years. If you will, tell us a little bit about your background in this field and then kind of how long you've been involved in this kind of research.
I was originally more involved with the robotic side of things, particularly looking at how little robots could be intelligent, getting them to learn and communicate with each other, a lot of the things that we would regard as intelligent acts. And lots of stories from those times. I think one robot that we had was learning how to move around in a corral, a little area, just to avoid walls. And essentially what we were doing was rewarding it when it did something positively. So if it moved forwards and didn't hit anything, and then if something came close by, it moved away from it. So we were giving it rewards, essentially just getting it more likely to do what it was doing with its wheels in order to avoid hitting things. But also punishing it if it kept bumping into things, so getting it less likely to do that. And there's one robot that we had just on a one-off time in the end, because we kept punishing it all the time. It was in a demonstration in a school, and the children there were just stopping it doing when it tried to move around. They wouldn't let it move. So essentially, every time it tried to do something, it was wrong, and in the end, it just stopped doing anything. So effectively, you get extreme cases, I think, with robots learning, where even if they have a goal they're trying to achieve, they might well not even attempt to do it. Effectively, it was a robot committing suicide, I guess. But that's from way back, stories into robots.
Interesting. And what kind of sparked your interest in robotics to begin with?
I think as a teenager, I was always excited by technology. So I had a motorcycle and used to try and change the different components on that to make it go a bit faster than it should do. So I had an interest in technology, but at the same time, when I was a teenager, various science fiction stories were starting to come out in this area. So we had things from the past like H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, but more importantly, Michael Crichton, he wrote a book at the time called The Terminal Man. This was about a guy having electrodes put into his brain. I think he was a psychopathic killer in the book, but I read it more as a science book. So I think science fiction at the time, which would be in the 60s was and early 70s, was starting to get into the sort of things that later on science fiction became Terminator and Matrix and so on. But there were forerunning the former science fiction stories about that time that later led on to things like Terminator were around. So it was quite an exciting time. In the UK, we had a series called Doctor Who.
Yeah.
He was time traveling and he met up with different machines like the Daleks and the Cybermen and all sorts of things, which I guess spark your imagination as a young child and then as a teenager.
Ah, indeed. Well, I saw some of the pictures in your photo gallery, and basically you're running around with a few robots that are very similar to the Daleks, right?
Well, actually, there is one particular one. It was a student project, and what the students were supposed to be doing as part of their degree course, and what they were doing was building an autonomous robot that would move around in the building and try and locate fires. So essentially, it had infrared detectors. The Dalek has this eye in the center, and it had infrared detectors in this eye that could locate fires. So what it would do would move around a building looking for fires, something burning, and then it would put the fires out. It would extinguish the fires. So it was an autonomous firefighting robot. But rather than build it looking like some boring piece of machinery, what they did was build it as a Dalek. So we had to get permission from the BBC and Terry Nation, the guy who actually owned the copyright, to build this Dalek, which they gave us permission to do it as a student project. So now what we've done with the Dalek, we've got it just remote controlled, and we use it as much for demonstrations and sometimes for open days when students are coming around. But that was a pretty good student project originally.
Wow, very interesting. And, you know, so what would you say are some of the main areas that you focus on today in regards to your research?
Ah, today, well, you mentioned the cyborg implant studies, and clearly at the moment I'm continuing that area, looking particularly at brain-computer interface, and particularly where in the brain to put implants for bidirectional links. So I'm looking forward myself to having another implant in years to come. But at the moment, it's studying where in the brain to actually make the link. That's one project. And another project is with Parkinson's disease. There is a deep brain stimulator that some patients have, which pulses electronic signals into the brain to counteract the effects of Parkinson's tremors. And what we're doing with that is trying to monitor the signals in the brain, right in the central area of the person's brain, and use an artificial intelligence system, an artificial neural network, to predict when the tremors are going to occur. So what it's doing is monitoring the electrical signals, the electrical activity deep in the person's brain,
mm-hmm.
and learning the particular features of the brain that result in tremors. And it is predicting accurately. We've got the system predicting 15 to 20 seconds ahead of tremors occurring. So effectively, it is getting a computer brain to outthink a human brain. So it's using an artificial neural net to understand in a particular way how a human neural net is working. The third project, these are the three main projects, and the third one is taking neurons, originally they're rat neurons, but brain cells, and culturing them, growing them on an array of electrodes, and after 2 to 3 weeks, linking them up to a little wheeled robot body, and the neurons are driving this robot around. So it's just very simple things at the moment, just getting the robot to move around and not bump into things. So if it comes close to the wall, it moves off to the right or left, and keeping moving around. But the big project side of it, the experiment, as it were, now, is not so much culturing the brain, which is quite a challenge, and keeping it alive, but it's more getting it to learn. How do we get this biological brain to learn? Because you can't change probabilities as you might do, change numbers as you might do with a computer brain.
Right.
You can't give it an ice cream or something like that. You have to try and change how the neurons operate, change how they communicate with each other based on voltages and currents. So it's really exciting research, trying to figure out how to get this biological brain to learn to move around a little bit better.
So your research dovetails very much then, I guess, with the overall research that is done on the brain, and specifically the neural network of the brain, right?
Yes, oh yes. I think in each case, my work is very practical, and that has always been the case. Sure, can write the theoretical papers that probably in the academic world we need to do to get the publications and satisfy the people that pay us. But what really excites me about the research is doing practical work with robots, building practical robots with neural networks, actually building them and getting them to do something, and particularly with the human brain and human nervous system, to actually do projects that involve the outside world and communicating with the nervous system, with the brain, so get something happening, not just in a theoretical or philosophical sense, but practically.
Right, right. And I mean, there have been some developments recently in regards to the interaction between monkeys and robots. There was an article a while back from the BBC, for instance, that talked about the successful experiments in regards to that a monkey actually managed to control a robot's arm just by using its brain. Have you heard about that?
Yeah, well, Andrew Swartz, I think there are a couple of people. Miguel Nicolelis got some good results 3 or 4 years ago. Andrew Swartz now from Pittsburgh, I think this was the results that you're just referring to. Where there are electrodes in a monkey's brain, and signals from the monkey's brain are used to move a robot arm, and the monkey gets feedback visually and can learn how to move the arm more successfully to pick up objects and so on. So, yeah, I think it's very relevant work, but what I would have to say is the two things. One is at the moment that it is just picking up signals, monitoring signals, from the monkey's brain and using those. It's not actually putting signals into the brain other than via the visual feedback, what the monkey's looking at. But
yeah,
the implant is unidirectional. What we've done so far, firstly, it's with humans, not with monkeys, and secondly, it's bidirectional. So, and I think this is critical. At the start, you mentioned feeding ultrasonic signals in as a new sensory input. And that has been an important aspect of it, is feeding signals in as well as picking signals up out. But Andrew Swartz's work is, and Miguel Nicolelis with monkeys, I think it certainly helps us understand what might be possible. But for me, the exciting work really is as far as humans are concerned. I think with the monkey, it'd be difficult to get the monkey to understand if you're putting in an ultrasonic signal. For a human, you can explain what the person's likely to experience. But for a monkey or a rat or some other creature, trying to put over the technology that's involved and what the signals might mean, I would imagine would be very, very difficult.
Mm, yeah, indeed. And I mean, well, we're on the subject of the human interfaces here, so to speak. Let's backtrack a little bit and talk about what you have done to yourself then. I mean, you have this in two steps, basically. One back in 1998, and then you did an upgrade, if you will, back in 2002. But let's backtrack to 1998 and start with that, and tell us what you did and exactly what the procedure was like and so forth.
You know, it's amazing to think it is 10 years ago now, but at that time, one has to think back to the mid-1990s. There were then various scientists, people like Ray Kurzweil, and I know Peter Cochrane, who was then head of British Telecom Research Labs in the UK, and a lot of people were saying, in the future, we are not going to need passports, we're not going to need keys for our cars, we're not going to need credit cards. What we'll have is a little implant that will do everything for it. Will link to the computer will know who we are from the implant that we have, and that will be the future for humankind. But nobody had actually tried it at that time. And so I did. I had a radio frequency identification device implanted by my doctor in my left arm, and we tried to see what we could do with it, which we were able to, within my department. We had various pickup points and a computer controlling various systems in the department. So when I walked towards my laboratory, the computer, via the implant, the computer knew it was me, so it opened the door for me. Down the corridor, it switched on lights for me. Coming through the front door, it said, "Hello, Professor Warwick," as I came in, because it knew it was me.
Right.
And I guess what we were doing was just using that to demonstrate at the time what was possible, and hopefully people's imagination could see where to take it from there. But it was amazing. At the time, there was quite a bit of interest from the outside world, and that was tremendously exciting. And now, I think a lot of people have got cats or dogs that have got a similar type, a smaller version, but a similar type of implant that they use for identification.
Mm.
There are various nightclubs. There's some called the Bayer Beach Club. There's one in Barcelona, one in Rotterdam, and you can get an implant of this type, and then you don't need to pay for your drinks with cash. You can get your drinks charged to your implant, as it were. It's actually to your bank account, but you use your implant, which is scanned. And even in the US, United States, some people with diabetes, some people with epilepsy have an implant of this type, and it gives in an indication of the medication they need when they go into hospital. So it's a bit like a medical record that is implanted. So there's quite a few examples. Other examples in security. I think in Mexico, some of the members of the government have an implant of this type. So lots of examples where people now actually use the implant of this type in an actual practical way. But back in 1998, as far as I'm aware, then I was the first human to actually try it out.
Hmm, interesting. And absolutely right. There are a lot of places that this begins to pop up on now. And I did not know that it was a standard, if you will, RFID or radio frequency identification tag that you embedded, if you will. But can this...
Well, that was the one in 1998. Yeah.
Right, right. And can this both send and receive, or is this simply a set of you know, a string of numbers within that identifies this tag, and then this tag enables the surrounding system to pick up on this number? Is that how it works?
Yes, it doesn't. The signals don't get changed. And the only way you can change the signals is externally. You can reprogram the device to send out a different code. But essentially, all that happens normally is that the coil within the implant or within the device is energized, and the device then transmits out a particular sequence of numbers, which you can use for identification purposes, or, as I said, with the diabetes patients, that it gives an indication this medication is needed, how much of a particular medication to use. So depends what you're using for, but an identification indication signal that identifies you or the device uniquely is the simplest thing to do. But it's not affected, not changed by what's going on in your body. And when any signals are passed down to it, whether to energize it or to change the code, that's not affecting what's going on in your body. So it's just sitting inside your body. But I think one thing to say on this, what I did find, which was quite surprising at the time, having an implant like that mentally, very quickly, you regard it as being part of you. It's mm-hmm. you. It's part of your body. And this is very different to having something on the outside. If you're wearing glasses or you have a ring or a watch, it's external. It's not you. But once you put things in your body, mentally, very quickly, you regard it as being you. It's part of you. And this is the same. People that have a heart pacemaker, or people that have a cochlear implant in their ear, or people that have artificial hips. In each case, when you talk to somebody, they'll say, yeah, this is me. Mentally, they regard it as being them. So although this implant, it was just a dormant thing, and unless it was actually activated, mentally, I felt it was me.
Interesting. And so what happened there? I mean, did you take this upon yourself, so to speak, to become a test person / guinea pig for the university's behalf? Was that the case here?
Yeah, well, I guess so, yes. I wanted to actually go for it myself and try it out. But also, I mean, when you do something for the first time, you're not really sure exactly what's going to happen. You think it's going to be all right, but you don't know. Yeah. And this, what we used, wasn't really supposed to be for putting an implant, and it could easily have gone wrong. It was in a little glass tube, and the doctor that we were working with said, oh, we've got to sterilize it before we put it into your body. So the first one we tried, we put one in as you do, a bit like school children, I guess. We put one in some boiling water, 100 degrees centigrade or whatever, and tried to sterilize it by boiling it. And what happened is it exploded. It just blew, and we had big pieces of electronics all over the place.
Oh my.
So the one that we used was put into an oven, and I think it got heated up to about 80 degrees centigrade, and the doctor said, oh, that's going to have to do. It should be all right. But it always was a bit of a problem. If somebody had hit it, the glass could have smashed and there could have been little bits of electronics floating around my body. And then things like whether the implant would migrate and whether the body would try and reject it, throw it out. These were all questions that we didn't really know the answer to at that time.
Right, but in regards to your body rejecting it, has that been a case? Do you have to take something in order to prevent this?
For that one, no. I mean, I simply taking some antibiotics, maybe. The second implant, which we haven't talked about yet,
right.
Which was back in 2002, that was a lot more serious. And that one was in for just over 3 months. But quite the converse. I took a few antibiotics to start with, but what we found with that one was that my body tissues within my body grew round the implant, pulling it into place. So far from my body rejecting the implant, quite the opposite happened. It very much accepted it and was pulling it in, making sure it actually worked okay, as it were.
And so do I understand things correctly when you say that you don't have it in your body anymore, the second implant?
That's right, oh, yes. No, it was very much just an experiment, as I said, for just over 3 months.
Uh-huh.
I think I've probably still got some wires left in my arm. The surgeons removed most of what there was, but there's still a few wires left in. But part of the experiment was to see what had happened to the implant, how had the body tissue interacted with the spikes, with the electrodes, and how did the electrodes interact with my body? But what state was the implant in when it got removed?
So, I mean, that's very interesting. And tell us a little bit more about this the second implant. What was the difference between this and the first one? And could it do more, so to speak?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was very, very different. The second one, it looked a little bit like a hairbrush, but it was very, very small. 100 electrodes, 100 spikes. Each spike was 1.5 millimeters long, and this was fired into the median nerves in my left arm. Now, the median nerves, the whole bunch of nerve fibers, which take signals down to your hand to move your thumb and the main fingers, and take sensory signals back up to your brain. And it, what we did was a bit like putting an electric plug in a socket, but instead of having two pins or three pins, as an electric plug has, this had 100 pins, and there was no socket. This was fired into my nervous system. So what the surgeons did was remove some of the myelin sheath. This is the outer covering on the nerve fibers for mm-hmm. protection. Mm-hmm. Removed some of that, and then literally hammered this 100 electrodes into my nervous system. And then I had wires which came from the electrodes coming out of my arm and onto a little contact set, a sort of terminal set, a little gold terminal. So and then that was all stitched up in place. So for just over 3 months, I had this plug with 100 electrodes in my nervous system and then wires coming out of my arm, and we could plug these into the computer. And either when I moved my hand, neural signals, brain signals, we could send off to the computer and do things with them, like switch on lights, for example. But also we could send signals down from the computer onto my nervous system to stimulate my brain.
Really?
And it took about 6 weeks for my brain to learn to recognize those pulses. But once that had happened, then we could do a whole range of experiments. So for just over 3 months, I had this plug socket fitted into my nervous system, which allowed us to communicate signals to my nervous system, to my brain, but also for us to send neural signals out to operate different pieces of technology.
So could you operate this by thought then?
The answer is not really, but yes.
Right.
Because my neural signals down my nervous system, they would move my hand. If I had been paralyzed, as some people are, this exactly the same neural signals, they wouldn't move anything, but they're still generated. If I thought about moving, there would be the same signals. And it was those signals, the neural signals, that we used to operate technology or whatever. We got them to switch on lights, to drive a wheelchair around. For the hospital that we were working with, they were looking to assess this technology. So for somebody who was paralyzed, for somebody who had a spinal injury, let's say, and they couldn't move, could this technology, this implant, be put into their brain? So when they thought about moving, the same signals that we were picking up for me, we could use those signals to drive them around in a wheelchair so they could operate themselves in a wheelchair. They could drive themselves, which obviously would be very useful. It would save a lot of time and effort from people pushing them around. They could sort it out for themselves. So effectively, yeah, it was my neural signals. It was my brain signals we were using, but I was moving my hand to generate the signals because that's what happens when I try and move my hand. Actually, my signals move my hand. If I was paralyzed,
right,
they wouldn't.
And so what about the other way around? You said that from the computer or from this central interface, then you could send signals into your body and to your brain. What tell us a little bit more about that. How did that work?
Yes, well, that took 6 weeks for my brain, about 2 weeks before we got signals in that my brain could understand. And essentially doing that, no one had done anything like that before. So there was no book that we could go and see what type of signals to send into my nervous system that my brain could understand. What magnitude of signal, how big should the signal be, what frequency of signal. So we had to try different things. Essentially, it was a current signal that we were pumping in, and what we found was with applying 40 to 50 volts to my nervous system via the electrode array, at about 80 microamps, of a particular signal, particular biphasic, it goes positive and negative, this particular type of signal, my brain could start understanding these pulses. So every time we pumped a signal in, my brain recognized a pulse. at first, when we first did it, the sense my brain made of the signal was that it was like a charge running up my index finger. So every time we put a pulse in, my brain understood that to be a charge running up my index finger, some current running up my index finger. Mm-hmm. Of course, that wasn't what was happening, but that was the sense my brain made of it. It had to make some sense of it. Mm. But then subsequently, when we did different things, we, for example, ultrasonic sensors, like ultrasound sensors that a bat uses, we had some of these sensors on a baseball cap. I was wearing the baseball cap. The output from the sensors was fed down via the electrode array to stimulate my nervous system. So as objects came closer, the pulses of current increased. There were more of them. Mm-hmm. And as objects went further, as an object went further away, so the pulses of current got fewer, died down. Mm. So what was happening with the ultrasonic sensors was, as an object came closer to me, my brain was receiving ding, 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 lots of pulses of current.
Right.
As object moved away from me, the ultrasonic sensors were sending signals down, so the pulses ding, 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 died away.
Right.
So these were pulses of current going to my brain that my brain was then able to understand. Even with a blindfold on, so I couldn't see what was happening, but my brain was unable to understand from these pulses of current that it was receiving that there is an object that is moving closer to you or further away from you, and how far it was away. So it was very much having a new sense, an ultrasonic sense, which gave me an indication of distance. And when something was moving to me or from me. So with the blindfold on, I was able to move around in my department and detect objects. I didn't know what they were, but I knew there's something there or not. And then Ian, one of my researchers, he brought this big board towards me, and what I was trying to do was to stay a distance away from the board using the ultrasonic pulses, trying
right.
to keep the frequency of pulses about the same. And as he moved the board away from me, so again, I would move towards the board. I was sort of following it ultrasonically, trying to keep the same distance away, and that was very successful.
Like a bat, I guess, in a way.
Exactly like a bat, yes. It
right.
was an ultrasound, a sonar sense. But for humans, of course, it's not a sense that we don't have generally, but it opened up my mind as to the possibilities. Maybe we did have senses like that in the past. Maybe we've lost them through evolution. But certainly
right.
it was something that my brain was very quickly able to take on board and use. What we had done really was to take some of my nerve fibers and to use them for our purposes, to provide a different sensory input that I could use. Now clearly that could be useful for a blind person,
right.
to give, not to repair their blindness in any way, but to give them a different sense that they could potentially use to help them move around. But for everybody, it is an extra sense. It's a different sense.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit about, I'm thinking back to an article about a year ago back that actually talked about a little brush that the Verichip Corporation had, or at the time actually Applied Digital Solutions, a kind of a parent company to Verichip, that when the FDA approved the you know, implanting of microchips in humans a while back, the FDA did a follow-up study that actually pointed to the fact that in some animals where they've done the implants, there actually were a cancer link to that. Have you heard about this at all, and is this something that has come up at all in regards to your research about this?
Well, I have to say it's nothing that's come up as far as my research, but I have heard of that study. I'm really not sure that it's an FDA, though. What I understood it was another company that had reported on some study in rats from about 10 or 11 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And they put out this report that some of the rats had been affected, there was a link with cancer and so on. My feeling of it was that they had not done any report until, or made any report, until it seemed to be commercially in their interest to do so. And this was against VeriChip and as a company. I mean, I have to say, I have no interests with VeriChip. I have no commercial interest in this at all. So this is not me stating it because I've got 10% interest in VeriChip or sort of making money. I'm not. I'm making no money in it at all.
Right.
But it did seem as though there was some commercial espionage, but it was more of a commercial study, research, report. And scientifically, there was nothing out there. There's no academic paper on this study whatsoever. There's nothing. If you go on Citation Index, there is no scientific evidence in any practical, sensible, peer-reviewed way or form whatsoever on the study that was reported. It was something I felt very irresponsibly, because if there were some results, and the results had been out for some time, they should have been reported on long, long before. The company that was reporting them, I felt, were acting very irresponsibly if they had not reported them before, and if there was some sort of link with cancer. But I felt that it's a shame for VeriChip, really. Maybe it did knock their business back a bit, which it shouldn't do. I think it is serious. The possibility should be looked at.
Of course.
If there is a feeling that there could be some link with effects with cancer, then there should be a proper study carried out under scientific terms, and reported in a scientific way in peer-reviewed journals, maybe a medical journal. But that is not the case in this instance.
And such
I feel to treat it with any great seriousness, I think you should raise an eyebrow and say, well, maybe there's something, but we need to look at it, but not to take it seriously at this stage, I think. I mean, right. I have to say, looking technically at what happens with radio frequency signaling in this case, the amount of power that is being used is so small for it to actually have an effect of this type. I think all of us, if we listen to a radio and put the radio next to our ear, a transistor radio or something, we'd all be getting cancer from all sorts of radio signals. I really think it would affect lots and lots of people. I don't know that this is with a radio frequency device implanted, that it is providing any much more specific high-powered system than you would get in everyday life. So
right.
I am extremely skeptical of any results anyway, but until they are actual scientific results, I think we should all be a little bit skeptical.
Right. But there, as you mentioned, then there haven't been a wide study like this done then, I guess.
No. And I mean, maybe there should be, so that
sure.
People can rest assured that it is okay.
Yeah.
Or not. If there is a problem, then we should know about it. But
of course.
At the moment, there has not been a scientific study conducted, no.
Okay. And I mean, when you had this implant in your arm, the second one, the upgrade that you did in 2002, was this powered by anything? Did you have a battery to it? How did that work?
We actually powered it. It was a battery, but the battery I wore externally, I had a little gauntlet arrangement, a little armband that I could wear that had a battery and then an antenna as well, a little aerial in there that if I didn't link directly into the computer, I could wear this and move around and send signals could be sent from my nervous system remotely and picked up remotely.
Mm.
We did look originally, would be going back to about 2 years before that implant. We looked at seeing, could we implant the whole device? So they have the power pack and the antenna, all the electronics implanted. And it would have been possible. But at that time, when we talked to the surgeons, and it was, look, what we'd like to do is to implant it fully. And the main surgeon that we were working with said, well, how big is it going to be? How small can you make this? Mm. And we said, it's about the size of a cigarette packet, roughly speaking. That's as small as we could make it. And the surgeon said, no way am I implanting something that size.
Right.
If you, his words were, if you make it as small as a cigarette lighter, then maybe I can implant it. But at the time, that was not possible. We couldn't get the electronics that small. So that was why I had some was implanted, wires coming out my arm, and then there were the power pack and the antenna and everything else was external. As it happened, that was very, very useful because the very first week that we were trying to use the implant, what we had done was to look at medical textbooks to see what frequency of signals were on the nervous system.
Mm.
And the textbook said, well, up to 1 kilohertz. 1 kilohertz is the maximum frequency. This is what all the medical textbooks said. And when we first looked at the signals we were getting on my nervous system, there were signals up to 6 kilohertz, 7 kilohertz, much, much higher than the medical textbook said.
Really?
So what we had to do, first of all, was to redesign the electronic circuitry so that we could transmit these signals out. So it's simply a case, I mean, we discovered why the medical textbooks had made this error, so to speak, subsequently, but essentially it was useful having the electronics on the outside rather than implanted them. Otherwise, we'd have missed out on a lot of the data that we were able to get.
Huh. And you know, that was interesting that you mentioned that. What was the faulty aspect in the medical journals or medical texts?
Well, it really goes back. It goes back. There's a couple of guys, Hodgkin and Huxley, won the Nobel Prize in about the 50s. Doing some work on squid neurons and really extending the results they've got to be applicable to human neurons. So a lot of people have taken the work of Hodgkin and Huxley and applied that to the same results, although they're from squid neurons, which are quite different to human neurons, but applied the same sort of results.
Really?
Now, one of the ways that neurons are measured is there's this method called a patch clamp method, which is like a glass tube with an electrode in the middle of the tube. And this patch clamp has a high frequency cutoff signal of 1 kilohertz. It's part of the measurement system. So if you use this to measure, you don't get any signals above 1 kilohertz. And it appears that what has happened is that people in the field will use this technique to measure and say, oh yeah, well, we don't get any signals above 1 kilohertz, therefore all of the signals we are of any relevance are below 1 kilohertz.
Right.
And this gets and so it's become a sort of a folklore that all of the signals of interest on the human nervous system are below 1 kilohertz, whereas in fact that it's not true at all. It's just because of the way they've been measured, this and this folklore has crept up. Hopefully things will change, but I think you still, if you ask 9 medical people out of 10, they'd probably still come up with this 1 kilohertz.
So what we can
rubbish.
Say? So what we can say about that is that the human nervous system, or the current, if you will, of the human body is much higher than we previously thought. Then, right?
Yeah, the signals on the nervous system are a lot more complex than had been thought. I think in this case, yeah, there's a lot of frequency, a lot of signals going on, and if you restrict it to 1 kilohertz, you're going to miss out on an awful lot. It may not just be human neurons; it may well be a lot of other, maybe the monkeys, maybe the rats, even, and so on. There may well be high frequency signals that are being missed out because of the method of measurement.
Wow.
So I think it's just a, you know, check on it. I think the big thing was we were coming at it from not so much from a medical point of view. We were mainly technology people,
right,
and we're not bogged down by a lot of the the ways that you have to think about. You have to think about it this way because this is how you've been trained to think about it.
Right.
We came in from a technological aspect which didn't have the same limitations, so we weren't so restricted in what we were doing, and hence we're able to look at things in a much broader way and perhaps understand what was going on in a more complex way.
Very interesting. Before we round things off here in the first segment, I have a few more questions that I want to kind of squeeze in here. So the first one is a little bit actually about the privacy issue. A lot of people who are kind of not only developing the technology, but also kind of on the outside looking in. If we talk about the, for instance, the RFID systems, there have been a little bit kind of articles here and there that pointing towards the fact that it might be a lack of security. If someone, for instance, with the right equipment who can read or access the information on the RFID tags, then this is something that the information on there, or the number on there, if you will, can actually be taken or stolen or copied, if you will. Is this an issue at all, do you think, at this point?
Yeah, I think it's an enormous issue. In general, with the implant that we've been talking about, even with the RFID as well, the technology has moved things forward enormously and allowed us to do all sorts of things that we were not able to do for identification, for sending neural signals, whatever it happens to be. But that opens up requirements for more security, much greater security, for the possibility of people hacking in or changing or finding out what's going on when they shouldn't is now much greater, and the information that they can find out and the effects that they can cause by what they do are much greater. And I really feel that the security aspects are not keeping pace at the moment.
Exactly.
And hence it is opening up all sorts of opportunities for people to defraud systems or find out pieces of information that perhaps they shouldn't find out. Because the technology is being pushed forward quickly and being used quickly, because it is tremendously powerful and changes things so dramatically.
Of course.
So yes, it I think identity theft and identity issues and finding out about an individual one way or another, there are considerable opportunities which security needs to be much, much tighter. I mean, it needs research on the security side, and perhaps it's not going ahead anywhere near as quickly as it should do at this time.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, one more thing I want to ask you before we run things off here is, you mentioned the financing. Are any kind of private corporations involved in this in regards to the university financing in the work that you do, of course, or is this military of defense? Who's involved here? You mind me asking?
Some of my research, I mentioned the project with the rat neurons and the robot. That's a research council, so that's gaining money from the United Kingdom government, effectively pure research money in that sense.
Uh-huh.
I am involved in a European project called FIDIS, which is the future of identification in society, and that is looking at those issues. That is funded by the European Community.
Uh-huh, really?
For the implant work, some of it has been funded by the Medical Research Council in the United Kingdom, but a lot of it has been funded by companies, particularly network companies, computing software companies. So Nortel Networks, Computer Associates, Fujitsu, these would be companies. Tumbleweed Communications, they were are a security company. They were one of the funders for the project. They were covering some of the security aspects, particularly, as well as helping to fund the project when we were communicating. I was communicating nervous system to nervous system with my wife as part of the project, and we needed to try and lay on a little bit of security so we didn't get people hacking into our nervous system. Tumbleweed came on board to help us with that. So mainly companies, and particularly network companies, as far as the implant research.
Very interesting. Kevin, I want to leave the first segment here with you telling us a little bit about how people can find your website, and also, of course, mention a little bit or talk a little bit about your book, iCyborg. I guess that the many things we've addressed so far is things that you bring up in your book. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's right. iCyborg is a little bit like an autobiography. In fact, on Amazon, you can get it from Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk, and I think there's a review on one of them, I'm not sure which, that says the book's all about myself, and this is a criticism that it's about myself, which is quite amazing, as it's an autobiography, which I thought that's what autobiographies were supposed to be. Sorry if the person who wrote the review is listening in. I apologize if I've upset you, but an autobiography is supposed to be about yourself, I thought. But it's really looking at why I've done the experiments that I did and a little bit of background into putting the experiments together, the mm-hmm. sort of heartbreak when you don't get things going the way you want, the problems with getting funding for doing the project, and then the background as to how the projects came together. It's all done in a fairly straightforward language, a chatty language, so hopefully people can relate to it. But the book is called iCyborg, which obviously was taken a little bit from Isaac Asimov's iRobot,
right.
And looking at, in this case, the cyborg being a cybernetic organism, part human, part machine, and trying to see why the experiments came about and what we did in the experiments, such as extrasensory input, controlling a robot hand across the internet, and communicating nervous system to nervous system between my wife, a telegraphic new form of communication. So it's quite a chatty book, so hopefully if anybody does have a look at it, they'll enjoy.
Brilliant. The book is called iCyborg, and Amazon.com is the best way to go to find that. I also want to mention the website again, kevinwarwick.com, and go there to check out some of the research papers, photo galleries, and much more. But for this first segment, thank you very much for joining us. We're going to continue talking more after the break with Professor Kevin Warwick, and I definitely want to discuss more things that we didn't have time for in the first segment, especially in regards to AI, some of the more robotics research that is being done, the technological singularity, and things where things might be going here in the future. So just head on over to redicecreations.com, find out how to sign up and join us in our member section. But for this first segment here, thank you very much for joining us, Kevin. Stay with us and we'll discuss more after this break.
Thank you. Great.